I was reflecting on what to talk about this evening, what to explore, and maybe like many of you have been affected quite a bit by the events of the last few weeks. I don't know if the speaker a week ago addressed that. Was that addressed some a week ago? Okay, so so I'm not going to address the concerns directly, but I think the theme will be really a central Dharma theme that I think will give us an important reference point for looking at some of the phenomena of the last period of time, the last week, the violence in Charlottesville and so forth, and connecting it to our practice. And so the theme that I want to explore this evening, it's really really more the title of the talk, is 10 ways of practicing with those with opposing views. And I have 10 listed. I actually could have had like 13 or 15, but I thought 10 was a good number. It's been, you know, well tested in Western culture, and Asian culture for that matter. And so what I thought to do would be to see if I can get through the 10, but if I'm getting to the point where I think it'd be good to open up to discussion, and I'm only at number 7, I may just read very briefly 8, 9, and 10 and get to the discussion and leave you to work out 8, 9, and 10 in more depth. If I were speaking next week, I could be easy and just do half today and half next time, but I'm not. So, these guidelines are, in general, very appropriate for people who we're in relationship to, even in direct relationship, to who have different views, or we have some kind of difference with people who seem to be, at least temporarily, opponents, or even, quote-unquote, enemies. You know, whether they're at home, in our own minds, part of ourselves, at work, you know, in the extended clan of relatives, or whatever. So these are ways of practicing with people with whom we have challenges, especially different views. And I was thinking about this topic and looking through some of my files, and I came across an essay that my colleague Diana Winston wrote quite a number of years ago, which is related to this. I'm actually going to do different items, but she had a kind of a similar title, and it was called 7 Reasons Why It's Better Not to Hate Them. Parentheses, even if they really are horrible, greedy, corrupt, and completely deserving. Okay, so going through the 10. The first is remember guiding teachings and practices. In other words, when we get conflicted, when we, you know, whether again it's in relation to someone who's directly in our life, and you know, in relationships or in work, extended family, to come back to these guiding, very profound, radical practices. And they really are found in multiple traditions. I'm going to name several traditions. The first I'll name is from the teachings of the Buddha. Maybe some of you have been reflecting in light of the events in Charlottesville, some of your own reactions, or even going back quite a bit further. You know, we have that very powerful passage from the Dhammapada that many of you know. Hatred never ceases through hatred. It is only through love that it ceases. This is an ancient law. I think the actual literal term is like this is the eternal Dharma, or the eternal Dhamma. And so this ancient teaching that may be challenging for us, right? Or how do I practice that? Or how do I live up to that? Or, you know, or yes, but, right? So I think remembering these teachings can be very, very crucial. You know, whether it can also be the teachings of interdependence, that particular causes and conditions have led to what's happening. And we can come towards the situation with the aim of understanding, coming from the perspective of wisdom. And we also have the teaching further expanded about the kind heart actually being an appropriate response for everyone in every situation. Again, quite radical, right? And how many of us can really live that? For how many of us is this a very significant challenge? But we have the passage again from the Metta Sutta. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Buddha didn't say most living beings, or those living beings who follow my teachings. He didn't say that. He said all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. So again, radical teaching. I think if we take that seriously, it's demanding. It's a guide. It can be kind of the North Star, but it's not easy. And when, again, we have to even have some concrete practices that can, as it were, translate that teaching into practical guidance. That's what we want. Guidance from about 1,000 years later from the teacher Shantideva, also from the Buddhist tradition. Therefore, like a treasure appearing in my house, without any effort on my half to obtain it, I should be happy to have an enemy, for that person assists me in my conduct of awakening. In other words, taking everything as a learning process. A difficult person, so-called enemy, remembering the context of awakening. Again, not easy, not easy. This is from a great Tibetan teacher of the 20th century, Dogo Kensei Rinpoche. Unless the inner forces of negative emotions are conquered, strife with outer enemies will never end. Unless the inner forces of negative emotions are conquered, strife with outer enemies will never end. So very strong teachings. And we find, of course, quite similar teachings in other traditions. And I'm going to mention just a few here. You know, in the Jewish tradition, I think it's mentioned 36 times to bring kindness to the stranger. And the Torah is mentioned 36 times, which must have meant that people weren't getting it. Bring kindness to the stranger. Bring kindness to the person with you, with whom you have difficulties. And of course, that gets further developed with the teachings of Jesus. You know, very famous passages. I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to those that hate you. Pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Again, radical teaching. Fairly similar. And we have, you know, I could mention a lot of people, but I'll mention a few. We have the teachings of Gandhi and King, also the aim of working with enemies with the aim of having them become friends. Gandhi says, acts of violence create bitterness in the survivors and brutality in the destroyers. We aim to exalt both sides. A nonviolent revolution is not a program of seizure of power. It is a program of transformation of relationships. The acid test of nonviolence is that in a nonviolent conflict, there is no rancor left behind. And in the end, the enemies get converted into friends. Again, strong teaching. And again, we can look to Dr. King. We rise to the position of loving the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. one seeks to defeat the unjust system rather than individuals who are caught in the system. And he makes a distinction, if you remember some of his texts, between loving and liking. He says, you don't have to like them, just try to love them. Right. That's the first. Stay connected with these deep and powerful teachings. Secondly, work with the intention to bring these into practice. This is a big one. Remember, the hardest thing about our practice is not actually doing it, but it's remembering to do it. Right? So the cultivation of clear intention and the bringing of intention into situations is crucial for our practice. Can we remember the intention to work with some of the different practices, whatever they might be, empathy, compassion, remembering the teaching, etc.? Can we remember that and really set an intention to practice before, in as much as we know that we're going into a challenging situation? And maybe if we're caught by ambush or by surprise, can we take a quick bathroom break and come back to clarity of intention? Bathroom breaks are a major technique for contemporary practitioners. Not mentioned a lot by the Buddha, but still crucial. Especially if there's something that's, you're going into a situation quite a number of times, can you remember the intention to practice? And maybe, whatever, if you're going to a difficult meeting, I remember I had, a very difficult person in a work environment, and I would actually work with intention before every meeting. And I had to take public transportation. I would do walking meditation on the way to public transportation and do metta on BART and so forth. So can we work with intention? The third guideline, commit to empathy and understanding. And again, I'm speaking of empathy. I gave a talk on that, I think, in the fall of last year. And I'm speaking about empathy here more as a deliberate practice based on trying to cultivate empathy for the sake of connection and understanding. And so it can be a deliberate practice. And if you remember, I think when we did it, a little less than a year ago, I gave a concrete way to practice, which is to deliberately, when you're with someone, here we could say, when you're with someone with whom there is disagreement, different views, can you tune in to what you sense the person might be feeling? What are the emotions? And then also, what seems to matter for the person? And we can do actual very concrete practices. And the way we develop empathy, of course, is to cultivate the capacity where it's easier and not just wait till we have a difficult situation. So cultivate empathy in very easy situations. Tune into people's emotions. Develop empathy as an ordinary way of relating. Watch your tendency to go just into views, even if there are people who are friendly. Can you work with empathy? It sort of switches us into, so we're using, we're not just locked in, let's say, in thinking, but we're capable in every situation of having the heart present, essentially. And again, interpreting empathy as a kind of heart practice. Sometimes this means to listen quite deeply for what's there. Can I listen for the pain that might be there of a person with very different views, maybe a white nationalist or even a neo-Nazi? Can I tune in to what I sense might be there? And better still, maybe read some interviews, have a sense of what's there for that person. Can I listen beneath the surface you know, especially when we have a disagreement, can I listen beneath the surface? And again, the I like the distinction that's made in nonviolent communication between a sense of what really matters for the person. In nonviolent communication language, this is the underlying need. And that's taken as always legitimate. This is the need for security or for connection or for freedom, for autonomy. And that's distinguished from the strategies. The strategies may be highly unskillful, but can we tune in to the underlying positive need? Can we do that with opponents? Can we listen for what is that important need? Again, this would be connected with knowing that many people who may be, you know, participating in these marches may actually have legitimate pain and be responding in some way. And we'll come back to that. You know, part of, I think, there's also the dimension of understanding, you know, how legitimate pain gets co-opted and manipulated by different people, particularly those seeking or in political power. We'll come back to that point. You know, related to the cultivation of empathy is that my fourth guideline, which is cultivate compassion. Particularly tune in to the dimension of suffering of the opponent. And again, practices sometimes like, again, we can practice with compassion, especially where there are people whom we love, who we have differences with. It's easier then to tune in to where there's difficulty or suffering. And compassion practice as a formal practice can really help with that. We use phrases like, may you be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. We tune in to where there is suffering. Or we may do forgiveness practice and go away from the way that we simply are caught in our views and tune into the dimension of suffering or sadness or our own pain with a situation to really know that. Again, it can be very helpful to know the history with a particular person. And again, many of us do this in our close relationships. We may grapple and have really different views and get into arguments. And then, you know, if we have the opportunity and, you know, I think are wise and create the space where someone can simply speak as much as possible with first person language and say, this is what happened. This is what I was experiencing. You know, we know, you know, how many of us can know from first person, from our own experience, that when someone tells you how it was, with first-person language, without blaming me, and just trying to say, this is what I was going through, it's, you know, how many of us find it's rather easy to go to compassion and understanding, you know, that we can have those kind of experiences, right? And again, can we do that with the opponent? From Longfellow, if we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. Right? And again, this can be connected with some of our deeper spiritual teachings, Buddhist teachings. Again, the teachings are that every being is actually an expression of Buddha nature or of the depths of wisdom and love. And we get lost, we get cut off from that. You know, and one Aikido teacher says that when you fight and hold someone as an opponent, you have broken your connection with the universe. Mm-hmm. You've broken your fundamental connection with the universe. And so that can be a basis for compassion. There's a deep lostness with people, you know, with us when we're violent or fighting. You know, in a way we're thrown back maybe to the reptilian brain and we're far from our deepest potential in those moments. And can we work with that with opponents? And here, this is I want to read something from a very extreme version of that. This is from a book by, some of you may know, by Etty Hillesum. Anyone know the work of Etty Hillesum? Etty Hillesum was living in Amsterdam as a young woman in her 20s when the Nazis occupied Holland, occupied the Netherlands. And she kept a journal. She was Jewish, so she was very soon in the ghetto. And she actually eventually died in Auschwitz. And quite the stories and the journals are quite amazing. With Hillesum, really amazing accounts. She actually was given a chance to escape, but she said, I want to really be with the people. And so she went to Auschwitz. And this is from her writing. There was, in the Netherlands, there was people were taken first to what's called a transit camp, which is at a place called Westerbork. You know, actually was when I was in Israel in June and July, I actually went to a museum, which was in northern Israel. Not the famous Holocaust Museum, but it was another museum called the Ghetto Fighters Museum. There was a Ghetto Fighters Kibbutz, and they had a special exhibit on what had happened in the Netherlands during World War II. And so this is what she said. When I think of the faces of that squad of armed green uniformed guards, my God, those faces, I looked at them each in turn from behind the safety of a window, and I have never been so frightened of anything in my life as I was of those faces. I sank to my knees with the words that preside over human life. And God made man after his likeness. That passage spent a difficult morning with me. So that's in the most extreme circumstances. You know, amazing, right? To have that presence to work with that teaching. A fifth guideline, which I'm going to be brief on, is when you're with people with different views or in relation to people with different views, respond and act appropriately. Okay? Got that one? So I could say a lot more about that in my early version of developing this talk this afternoon. I actually had a few others spelled out, which spilled over and made me have 13 guidelines rather than 10. And I sort of packed them into, they're all were having different aspects of action. So this related to, you know, how do we act when harm is being done, right? We need to act. These practices are not about being passive. They're not about standing aside, right? They're also about action. But how do you do this purifying work, this purifying inner work, and still act? People like Gandhi and King, they acted, you know? Jesus presumably had his teaching at the same time that he, you know, turns over the tables of the money changers, you know, and so forth. So their action is required. So how do you act when there is harm being done? So of course, our old friend Wise Speech comes in quite centrally, and we could devote, you know, I just co-taught a 6-day retreat on that, so I have a few hours could say about that, but I'll just mention in passing, you know, skillful speech. I think wisdom about how to work with conflict, how to intervene with conflict is very, very crucial. How can I be myself a kind of a mediator and not be moved into dualism of right and wrong, us and them, you know, I'm right, they're wrong, you know, even if we act in a certain way. And I probably have to come back to that because that could take some clarification. You know, I mean, people like Gandhi or King thought that, you know, British colonialism on the one hand or racism on the other, in a sense, are wrong, right? Those are to be acted against, right? But again, it's maybe thinking of, as in that earlier quote, this is the system, and not trying to defeat the person, right? And seeing that person more as caught up in the system. And then all sorts of dimensions of what constitutes skillful action. Not easy, right? And again, I'm thinking about 2 weeks, I'm going to be co-teaching 3 days on this. So if you want more on item number 5, come in 2 weeks. Okay, and we can talk more about this. And again, I think each of these could be a whole talk, could be multiple talks, right? Okay, number 6. This will be a familiar one. In relation to opponents and people who seemed like enemies, those with different views, work with the judgmental mind and other forms of reactivity. Okay, that's familiar, right? Right. So again, the inner practice of studying what our mind does with opponents. What does our mind do when we have different views? Study it. Do I form a dualistic divide? Do I get polarized? Do I think I'm right and the other person is wrong? Do I get reactive? You know, and typically, again, the judgmental mind doesn't have any room for empathy or compassion. It's just repeating the polarizing thought over and over again. Some version of I'm right, that other one's wrong. Sometimes, of course, the judgmental mind says, I'm wrong, they're right. It goes there too, but in this context, it's that dualism, you know, the dualistic moral framework. We want to look into that, you know, as well as attachment to view. Again, it's not so much an issue of not having views, but when do we get tight, attached, grasping, leaving any room for trying to understand the other? So you see, with some situations, this is not easy. It's easier when you're, you know, with loved ones, and oh yeah, it's not so good to judge them. You know, how about neo-Nazis? Yeah, not so easy. And of course, we can ask about our own shadow. How am I like the one that I am judging? And we don't always like to go there. This is from Thomas Merton. It is not only our hatred of others that is dangerous, but also and above all, our hatred of ourselves, particularly that hatred of ourselves which is too deep and too powerful to be consciously faced. For it is this which makes us see our own evil in others and unable to see it in ourselves. Not an easy teaching, right? Not an easy teaching. We can see how we may actually be somewhat like those we criticize. It was interesting, in 1991 and 92, I made 2 trips to Eastern Europe, pretty extensive trips, about 30 days. And I went to Poland, I went to Lithuania, where 2 of my ancestors come from, and I visited a lot of places connect with the Holocaust. I visited some of the killing fields in Lithuania, a place near Vilna called Ponary. Visited the Warsaw Ghetto, Auschwitz, and so forth, and had 2 trips there. I actually approached going to Auschwitz as a kind of pilgrimage, you know, which was quite powerful. I went with my sister, went there and used a lot of ritual. I had some guidance from people who regularly did pilgrimages. And interestingly, of course, you know, there was a lot, you know, more understanding. A lot of reading came out of that period. But I also noticed over the next 2 or 3 years, I had a lot of dreams about Nazis, as you might expect. Part of the focus of the dreams was about seeing the degree to which I myself am sometimes act like a Nazi. Not expected, right? Not expected. That's how I understood quite a number of the dreams. It was not just going in and seeing the external, quote-unquote, evil, but also seeing my own connection with that. You know? Not what I thought, but that was inescapably the message of some of the dreams. You know? Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it this way: if only it were all so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds. Again, someone who, you know, was in the gulag and very familiar with the Soviet system. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? It's a strong one, isn't it? Right. So related to that, seventh guideline. I'm doing pretty well for time. I think I may get through the ten. We'll see. The seventh one is watch the tendency to dehumanize the other, or to turn the one who has a different view into an other, who is somehow not fully human. And of course, that's going to cut off the empathy and the compassion. Watch the tendencies to do that. And again, we can see that just with people who are in our everyday lives with whom we have disagreements, right? Where we go into that mind state where we turn them into an other, just someone with bad views or just doesn't get it, or, you know, kind of take away their humanity, right? Now the eighth is one that I could go on for a while. Know the history and dynamic of the particular views. And this is, I think, partly to know the personal history, you know, of where the views came from. And this can be particularly, I think, helpful with people with political views who may be very different than ours. That may be very different from ours. And so I think it's very helpful, you know, to read about people with different political views. It may be to meet them, talk with them, see what it is like from the inside. You know, and that's not easy because we may not have very easy contact or access to people like that. So to find it in reading, to find it in, articles, to find it maybe in books or novels. I remember doing a retreat, which I probably have mentioned from time to time. I did a retreat with a number of interfaith colleagues at Los Alamos Laboratory about 15 years ago, where we, it was basically, you know, generally an interfaith witness with nuclear weapons. And but we had lunch every day with the scientists and technicians. I remember that I was able to really listen as deeply as I could to them, very different views, and to hear where they were coming from. Because what happened in talking with me, at least, the people virtually always went to their own personal justifications of why it's good to be building nuclear weapons at Los Alamos. Without me saying a word, they went there, as if they needed to justify. I could sense that it wasn't 100% believed, right? And some of my colleagues, they immediately got in arguments with people. And there wasn't much chance to really listen. And we talked about that. You know, at the retreat, we would be there 9 to 5, and then we would go to back to a campground where we stayed, and we'd have a council in the evening. We would sit around kind of a, I don't know if we had a fire, but something. We sat around in the dark with some, you know, maybe a fire, some light, and we would just talk about our experiences of the day, and we shared that those different experiences of some people being able to actually to hear what are those views about, very different views. Where did they come from? What's the basis? And I think doing that, again, it may not be very easy. How can we, you know, can we learn the biography? You know, interestingly, some of you may have heard, there's been a lot of, I know I've heard on the program Democracy Now!, they've had program on people who were formerly neo-Nazis, who sort of shifted, came out of that. And they talk a lot about their own personal history. I think it's quite valuable to hear that. Again, with political views, knowing the degree that there may be a significant amount of pain and perhaps some accurate seeing of some issues or problems, you know, or feeling a lack of respect, you know. And that's one dimension, really knowing the accounts. And I think also knowing some of the dynamics of how people develop extreme views and the degree of manipulation by people with power. You know, you can certainly see that if you study Germany in the 1920s and 30s. You can see how, you know, people had all sorts of pain on different levels. that was manipulated. You know, you could say the same thing about different aspects of the last election, right? And can we understand, you can go back 400 years, or maybe a little over 300 years, you can see in the history of racism, how racism develops as a divide and conquer strategy. The history is very clear. If you go back to looking at the history in Virginia in the late 1600s and how there were, you know, in that period there was much more fluid relationships, and there actually were rebellions in which working people we now call white and people we now call black got together against the people who were rulers, who did not like it. And they figured out a very good strategy, which has worked for quite a few hundred years, right? And it's good to study that and know that, to know the degrees of manipulation. Study how authoritarian personalities, are reactions to certain conditions. I think that can help with understanding, as well as knowing how to address things, because essentially, you can know that there are other ways to address the underlying pain that is felt by people. Right? And there are skillful ways of doing that, and then there are these manipulative ways of doing that. Again, we can look into the dynamics of scapegoating and how that develops. And it's good to know the history. You know, study how the Nazis developed and so forth. Study how that's been done in the history of racism. You know, it's an important history to know, and you can have some larger perspective. Okay, number 9. When you have people with different views, number 9 says, work skillfully with difficult emotions that arise in relation to the person with the other views. Right? Of course, and this again could be developed in a lot of depth, but it's, we have, so you can see how we're bringing together different parts of our practice. The wisdom dimension, the quality of developing kindness, the mindfulness of being able to work skillfully with difficult emotions, the understanding of views, all sorts of different, so we, for these really difficult challenges, we need all the elements of our practice. So number 9, work skillfully with difficult emotions, including emotions like anger. How to work with those, and again, generally a combination of mindfully exploring, really looking into the emotions, seeing how they manifest for us, watching how we get triggered, being really experts in our own patterns of reactivity, and so forth. And then also bringing in practices like loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness, that help us keep balance when we're angry and give antidotes so we aren't locked in. Again, could say a lot more there, and I think we have in the past. And then last one, and then we'll go to some talking together. Do inquiry into why you have such a charge with this person's views. In other words, take the appearance of a radical split with someone because of views as a chance to inquire about what's there for you. Again, there's another aspect of inner work. And this is probably, I think it's relevant for all differences, probably most immediately relevant for people who are in our lives in an ordinary way. People with whom we're in relationship, people at work and so forth. And we suddenly get quite triggered by someone else's view. Do an inquiry, that we can ask certain questions. Why do I have such a charge? And what's there for me? Typically, again, reactivity virtually always covers over unacknowledged pain. Can I look into that pain? Can I feel that pain? Can I notice the tendency to polarize? Can I notice my thoughts and stories and different emotions? Can I ask, is there something possibly that I might learn from this person? Is there some experience in my past connected with this very charged reaction? consider role-playing the other person. We do that in the nonviolence training, you know, working with role play. In some ways, take, again, having an empathic approach could be a way of doing that. So maybe I'll go through the 10 of these again, and then I'll have a closing and we can talk together. So number one, remember guiding teachings and practices. Number two, work with the intention to practice. Number three, commit to empathy and understanding. Number four, cultivate compassion. Number five, respond and act appropriately. Number six, work with the judgmental mind and other forms of reactivity. Number seven, watch the tendency to dehumanize, to turn the other person into an other. Number eight, know the history and dynamic of the views, again, particularly if they are public or political views. Number nine, work skillfully with difficult emotions. And number 10, inquire into why there's such a charge with the other person. So I'll close with something from the Dalai Lama. At the end of a talk, someone asked the Dalai Lama, "Why didn't you fight back against the Chinese?" He looked down, swung his feet a little bit, then looked back up at us and said with a gentle smile, "Well, war's obsolete, you know." Then after a few moments, his face grave, he said, "Of course the mind can rationalize fighting back, but the heart would never understand. Then you would be divided in yourself, the heart and the mind, and the war would be inside you." Thank you. So I'll welcome any reflections or thoughts that could be related to what I said or more directly related to some of your own experiences following Charlottesville or anything that came up. Yeah, please.
Thank you. First.
Yeah. Oh yeah, well, use the mic.
So first of all, thank you.
You're welcome.
These are really difficult.
Yeah.
Can you hold the microphone closer?
I'm sorry. These are really difficult. And so it helps me and probably all of us to come up against where our limits are.
Yeah.
So one place where the discernment feels critical to me and it felt confusing is a distinction which I would still make, but I understand ultimately may not be real, between views and actions.
Mm-hmm.
So you intermix them in different places in ways that I found difficult. So it's one thing for me to try to understand, empathize, experience the pain of someone who has different views. Can't do it so much if it's different actions of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do it yet, or not in this lifetime. So atomic scientists or climate deniers or people who vote for Trump, yes, and I know there's no bright line, but neo-Nazis, people who are doing violence to other people, someone who's coming at me with a lead pipe, can't do it. And it feels confusing to me to talk about discernment, to talk about right action, because it seems to me that right action is different when it's a view or speech, as hurtful as that can be, and as lacking a bright guiding line. But when there is action, when people are being hauled off to concentration camps or put onto slave ships, it feels in a fundamental way different to me.
But by different, you mean that the teachings and practices do not apply?
For me, they do not apply yet.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see doing it.
Yeah.
And where I come up against a problem is that I still believe that people have choices, that it's not all determined. And so if someone has great pain and difficulty in their life, I can be deeply empathic about it. There's an important distinction for me between the fact that I can act like a Nazi or recognize that or see it in a friend, but then have remorse or be willing to engage or work on it, recognize it, feels an important distinction from people who don't do that and are unwilling to face that darkness in themselves.
So that's, yeah, maybe we should, finish, because you've made a lot of points. And they're interesting and helpful. So I could hear, I could notice my own mind having different kinds of responses. First of all, recognizing that when we talk about neo-Nazis or some of what happened in Charlottesville and try to bring these teachings and practices into that context, that we're dealing with a highly difficult type of practice. And that, as you know from those of you who've heard me before, I work a lot with that model of degrees of difficulty. You know, they use the model of the Olympic diver ascertaining the degree of difficulty from 1 to 10. And we're talking about 9s or 10s here, and probably 10s or 10 pluses. And the way, which I didn't bring out very much this evening, is that the way we develop all of these capacities, where they may be able to be more fully manifest at high degrees of difficulty, is work with the capacities and develop the capacities in situations of lower degree of difficulty. In other words, develop empathy and compassion, like I was saying, just in ordinary interactions where you don't even have differences of views. So that's a very important point in terms of recognizing that what we're talking about are highly difficult, in many ways, extreme situations. They're extreme situations, and like you were saying, I think you were saying that for me, it's hard for me to go certain places. You know, I might recognize the teaching, but you know, inside I can't go there. Right? So I think that's important. You know, and actually, if you read, I don't know if Dr. King went there, but I know that Gandhi did. Gandhi actually said in a number of his writings that he thought that having courage and acting violently was better than having no courage and acting nonviolently. You actually find those kind of qualifications in his teaching. So it seems like, in a certain way, there's almost like a developmental sequence. And he gave a certain, you know, he gave some room because he thought that responses were really important. So that's, I don't recall seeing something similar with King, but you do find that in Gandhi. So that's one thing. In terms of some of the examples, I don't know, I tend to think that some of the examples that you were given where there might be views, but not action, I think I would question some of it. I think that people on certain part of the political spectrum supporting certain candidates, definitely those views on climate issues, I think there are consequences, there are actions which you could say are happening. And so I think that it may not be the immediate personal action of that person, but collectively there's an effect, right? And I see by your nodding that I think you would agree with that. I think it's clearly the teaching that empathy, compassion, understanding are always appropriate. And skillful response to prevent harm is also always appropriate. You know, The question is, of course, how to do that in a skillful way. And we continually find the invocation to act in a way which doesn't simply come out of reactivity and doesn't keep the cycles of reactivity and violence going. So that's very clear. You know, and you do, I think you do find, you know, you do find in the lives of people like Gandhi and King, or maybe Dorothy Day, you know, they were working, they were speaking of people who were committing acts of violence. And there's, you know, if you look at King's writings, they're pretty remarkable passages where he tries to, where he manifests very developed empathy towards poor white racists, for example, you know, who have committed, you know, unspeakable acts, and he is able to make the empathic move with them, you know, in that context, you know. And so, again, with the sense of that they're actually being manipulated, which is, you know, where he went. And he, you know, he could see that. You know, he could see that very easily. He could, you know, and he went out of his way to try to talk to people like that. So I don't think I answered all of your points, but a few of them I did, right? And but I think there are a lot of hard questions, so thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. Please. And then in the back, yeah.
Thank you. I wondered if you'd given any thought the three rallies that are coming up, the great alt-right rallies that are coming up next weekend, what effective direct action, skillful response to those might be.
What are skillful actions for some of the rallies? some thought. I know my colleague Michael Lerner is advocating that people come out in large numbers in Berkeley the day before. There is to be a march, apparently, by people more right-wing, right? And to not actually engage directly. I personally think that the meeting of people with those kind of views with fighting and violence is not skillful for 10 different reasons. You know. But I think having a show of people standing up, as happened, I think, in Boston yesterday, and could happen on Saturday, if people get together, you know, the day before the march. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't thought this through carefully, but I think that somewhere, I forget, maybe some of you can let me know where this was. Maybe it was in South Carolina, but a group of professional clowns got together. And they, where was this?
Oh, wasn't it in Florida?
I think it was in a southern state, actually. Yeah, my mind said South Carolina, which is, what? There were, I don't know what the number, but a small number of clowns got together and just, you know, again, gave a more spacious way of approaching it.
White flower.
Yeah. White flower.
Wife power.
Right. Right. So I don't know, I haven't thought through that so much, but I am personally trained as a clown, as you know. So there's something about that is appealing, like bring out the clowns. You know, again, while combining that with empathy and so forth. That's not easy. So I think that the, you know, probably the strategy in Boston seems to have been quite skillful. You know, again, and this was skillful probably for the police to actually keep barriers. So mm-hmm. I think to have a very strong statement has happened. I think that was quite effective for my sense of things. To have a very strong statement without doing the fighting. That would be generally what I would counsel.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Please, wait, let's wait for the mic. A little closer.
You made a distinction between the people being manipulated and the manipulator.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is there really a distinction? Because the manipulator also has to have been manipulated at some point, either by themselves or their own shadows. And so I'm wondering, is that dualism intentional?
Yeah, the difference between the manipulators, typically people with a certain degree of power, and the those who are manipulated. I think I was the main motivation for that distinction was to both help to have some empathy towards those who are manipulated, and to also to understand the scapegoating and the divide and conquer strategies, so as to be able to develop strategies which give alternatives in those contexts. That was the main motivation for doing that. I think ultimately we want to, understand why people become authoritarian leaders, right? Or why people cling to power, or why people, use divide and conquer strategies, or we want to know the people who are scapegoating. And I think, I think ultimately, I think you're right. I mean, you can look into their histories. I mean, I've read biographies of Hitler. Maybe some of you have too. I mean, I know that Hitler had deep abuse as a child, right? It doesn't justify anything, but, he was a very damaged person. You know, I don't know enough about Mr. Trump's background, but there's some evidence of a very difficult childhood. Authoritarian father who was arrested at Klan rallies and so forth. So I think it's good to make that move, but I think it's a different, it's working on a little different level and addressing maybe different concerns. I think the teachings are have these approaches to every being, right? Yeah, thank you. It's a good question. Maybe last one, and then we'll go to the meta cards.
Yeah, I think for a long time it's been a distraction from other things, from looting and some pretty effective actions at rolling back the clock.
I say it meaning with
it,
reference
meaning,
to
meaning the show of bad clowns, of the red-haired clown, and of some of this. I believe this is like showing a red flag. They know how to deal with anger.
Yeah,
they being the people who run the country in a lot
That's
of ways.
That's right. Yeah,
and they already have a police state already for that. We are being manipulated.
Right.
By falling into anger, it's a simple tactic to distract or to like your cognition shuts down as you get angry.
That's right.
Instead of playing the game a little more creatively and
very very important point again, remember I said there are 10 reasons why I think the acting with violence against those with whom one disagrees, the neo-Nazis or the racists or white nationalists, I think is unskillful. That's a major one. The one you mentioned, that I think it plays into the hands of authoritarianism and repressive mechanisms. And it also distracts from the message very much. The media are all too happy to focus on the violence and lose sight of the core message. We've seen that in many, many situations. Again, we want to have empathy towards people who really are thinking that they're being very righteous with their fighting of people they think are fascist, right? I want to have empathy there, but I think that it's unskillful in many, many ways. So again, the one you mentioned, I think a major one.
Yeah.